I'm Matt Godbolt.
And I'm Ben Rady.
And this is Two's Compliment, a programming podcast.
Hey, Ben.
Hey, Matt.
So this is the first time we've recorded this while we listen to our own jingle to start with.
Yeah, that's right.
And I can't help but grin. It's so weird. It's so weird. I was expecting to... I'm so used to listening to this while I'm editing it.
Uh-huh.
And yeah. Then I had to remember, oh, no, I have to speak now.
Yep.
So what are we talking about today?
I had a vague idea of something that we can talk about. And
awesome.
As usual, I have 12 pages of copious notes on this topic. So there's no risk that I'm going to run out of things to say. In fairness, I don't think there's a risk that I'm going to run out of things to say on any topic at any time.
True.
But I have done zero preparation for this. So there's a chance that this is our first.
We'll see how it goes. Yep. It'll be fine.
But the idea that I had is avoiding abandonware.
Oh.
I think that we can talk about a particular phenomena that occurs a lot, that I see a lot in the software industry, that I read about a lot in software and technology and finance, basically any company that uses software, I see this phenomena. And it's regrettable, and I think it's somewhat avoidable, but also, like many things, is a product of sort of systemic forces. And it may not be possible for you as an individual to avoid it.
Right.
But it is certainly possible for companies to avoid it. So I think we could maybe...
That's interesting. I mean, it immediately makes me think of that XKCD with the big pyramid of things that companies are built upon, you know, from the bottom up, all these different pieces. And then there's this one thing like at the bottom right-hand corner, a tiny little sliver of a stick.
Yeah,
and the little arrow is, you know, that one library that some guy in the middle of nowhere is the only person left supporting. And it's like, well, you're talking about one step beyond that where nobody is supporting that thing anymore.
Well, yeah, that is a particular, so that's like the load bearing internet person.
Yes.
Who's like, you know, like all of modern technology is propped up by this one guy in Sweden. Right.
Right.
So this is not the, like, I think some of the same forces are at play here, but what I'm talking about is within the context of a company, a situation that I think occurs a lot where people will build a piece of software and it will go through certain phases, and the phases are roughly like in the early days, there's a lot of excitement about it. There's a lot of change that's happening. There's a lot of new development. And then the software starts to stabilize and then the software starts to kind of freeze, like be stable in a bad way.
Like ossify, really.
Yes, ossify. Like, that's a great way to describe that. And then, because it is difficult to change, the organization will start routing around it because they need change to happen because the world is change, but they can't change the software for various reasons, which we'll talk about. And then other bad things happen when they start routing around it. So I kind of want to walk through that sort of whole process from beginning of end to end of like a typical project, right?
Yep.
And how it suffers this fate and what happens to the people involved in it and what happens to the company, right?
I'm intrigued. Go ahead.
So starting off, I think a lot of projects, you know, the sort of greenfield project, right? And many of us have had opportunities to work on greenfield projects, and they're great.
Yeah.
And the reason that they're great is because they have zero complexity, right? There is
no dependence, no customers, nobody nagging you about it, no bugs.
You have no bugs. You have no dependencies. You have no code that you need to read. You have no slow test suite that you need to, you know, run for 12 hours before you can do a deployment, right? You have nothing, and it's great. And not surprisingly, one of the reasons that programmers love those kinds of projects is because they are very productive at the start. Right. And I think part of the reason why is, or they can be, you can also get tied down in a lot of, like, you know, analysis paralysis.
How should
and
I
other
do
things.
This? Yeah.
And, yes.
What technology should we use? And like, well, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So that can certainly happen and does. But there are many situations in which you started one of these projects and you have a very clear idea of what you want to build, or at least you have a rough idea, right? Like maybe recalling our iterative versus incremental episode
again.
Maybe you're like, well, I'm going to paint the Mona Lisa. So yeah. I know roughly what she looks like and I'm going to pencil that in and that's going to be my first draft, right? And you have a very clear vision in your head and you can be very productive. And as a person who likes writing code, there is maybe nothing more fun in the world than having that vision in your head and making it real, right? Or making some draft of it real, right? And so you're very productive. And then, you know, eventually, if you're doing your job well, you build some software that somebody wants. And, you know, like the Bjarne Straustrup quote about, you know, there are two things in the world, you know, the programming languages that people use and complain about and the ones that they don't use, right? And I'm botching that quote terribly, but you know, I'm hopefully getting the idea right. The precise wording is much more
pithy.
Yes. He's very good at that. But it's this where, you know, you build something that somebody wants and they immediately start complaining about it. And they're like, oh, this is great, but can you add this? And can you do this? And can you change this? And can you do this?
Often with the word just in it.
Right.
Can you just
make can you just, you know, make it 10 times faster? And so what happens is that you start having to adapt to change, which you didn't really have to do at the beginning, right? At the beginning, you're in this phase where you're like, I have this vision. I'm going to build a thing. I'm going to build it until somebody says, ooh, that's cool. And they start using it. And then you start getting some feedback, right?
Mm-hmm.
And some people will tell you to try to get to that phase as soon as possible. That's maybe a whole other discussion.
Yeah.
But eventually at some point in the process, you're going to start, if you're successful in building software that someone wants, they're going to ask you to change it, right?
Yep.
And they're either going to ask you to change it because the world changes, or they're going to ask you to change it because of some new capability that they want, or they're going to ask you to change it because they encountered a bug. But whatever the reason, they're going to ask you to change it. And then you're going to be in this process of changing it, right? Mm-hmm. And you're going to change it and change it and change it and change it. Now, I think we've kind of talked about before, we were in our technical debt episode, about complexity and how complexity is one of those things that I think is a more useful thing for programmers to talk about rather than the metaphor of technical debt.
Especially given how folks reasonably disagree on what debt is, you know, Ward's original idea is not how I use it and so on and so forth. And so complexity is something that I think we all have a better understanding about what we mean when we say this is complex, and there's necessary complexity and then there's the other kind.
right. Yes. And I mean, very, very practically here, it's like you start out in the Greenfield project, you have zero lines of code, right? You get to the point where you've deployed your first version and someone uses it and you have N lines of code. And then you get to the point where you're making change number 5,263 and you have some multiplier on N lines of code. And that is complexity, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it's more complexity than you need or less, it doesn't really matter. It's complex and it's hard to change and it's hard to understand and it's hard to add more people to the team so that you can add more changes, right? And all this gets slower and more difficult and harder. And eventually you reach a point where the people who are asking you for changes start to get frustrated because the changes aren't coming quickly enough. And in dysfunctional organizations, this can lead to situations where people are pressured to work long hours to try to get changes in. And then, you know, usually that adds to more complexity because they're bleary-eyed in the middle of the night trying to figure out how to do things, and that just makes the problem worse. And then it just gets slower and slower and slower. And eventually that frustration reaches a point where people say, okay, we shouldn't count on this system being able to change quickly, right? That's not a good strategic plan because they have shown in the past that they can't change quickly. And, you know, there are some really negative things that happen when a project reaches that stage. You know, people start seeing that the future of this thing isn't really going anywhere. They start to leave, which means, you know, you have a loss of talent working on the project, which again makes the rate of change even slower.
And you lose the institutional knowledge that they had when they leave. So,
Exactly right. So all that complexity that was maybe loaded up into someone's head, that head is now somewhere else right now, and you can't use it to figure out what the hell is going on in this code. The organizational support might start to get pulled away, you know, in terms of funding or in terms of, you know, other resources that the organization can provide. You know, it starts to be thought of as this thing that is in a more positive light may be stable and useful, but in right. a negative light, something that is old and crusty and legacy and no one wants to deal with, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But the needs of the organization are still there. And the reason that you built the software is probably still there. And so what happens is people start to route around it. And initially they may start to route around it by doing things on their own that the system also does or also could do. But for the reasons previously stated that it's difficult to change, they choose not to, or they feel like they can't, right? Yes. And that can be real or imagined. It doesn't even really matter, right? And so you almost get this like scar tissue where it's like the organization starts to like work around this thing that is part of the organization itself, like this critical piece of software, but they start routing around it.
Right.
And what I see quite often, and I think that's a pretty common pattern, and what I see quite often is that it can easily reach sort of a tipping point where people start to say, like, maybe you have like an inflection point almost where it's like two core developers leave the team or they leave the company because they're sick of working on this legacy thing that no one cares about anymore. Right. And then maybe they hire a couple new people to come in and take it over. And the new people look at it for 2 months and they're like, oh my God, this thing is so complex. What we need is a rewrite.
Right.
And now the cycle begins anew. You have a greenfield project where you get to do the whole thing over again.
I mean, there's well-documented version 2 problems of things, yes, as well.
Which second system effect and all of this other stuff, right? And you know, in dysfunctional organizations, this process of, you know, renewal, and renewal is a way too positive of a term.
Phoenix from the ashes kind of thing.
It's not nearly that good poetic for anyone.
Yeah.
Just happens over and over and over again. And so, you know, I think, you know, there are some ways that you can accidentally encourage this, and there are some ways that you can help prevent it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that at some point it is almost like the natural outcome of every project to sort of reach this point where it becomes difficult to change. And that can be for a number of reasons. It can be because of the complexity. It can be because so many people depend on the existing behavior that there just isn't that much left to change, right?
Right, right. The thing that immediately springs to mind when you talk about this is libcurl and the curl command line, right? Which is used in every program ever. And I know Daniel, I think his name is, I was subscribed to his GitHub repo, and I can see the changes going through. It's like, or zlib is another one, you know, that's another one. I find it fascinating to look at these things, which are essentially immutable and can't change ever again, because, you know, like gzip files have to keep working, deflate is a spec and it isn't changing, but they are maintained. And you'll see, taking zlib for it as an example, you'll see like lots of people come in and say, hey, I'd love to make this thing go faster, I want to change this thing, whatever, and they're immediately closed down with like, yeah, but unfortunately that exposes this issue and this bug, you're the 15th person to try and make this change, it doesn't work, really sorry, gonna have to write an FAQ for like why you can't do this or something rather than this. And it's well-meaning, but it's like it can't change because it is like so fundamental to everything. That's that. And likewise, curl, I mean, obviously both of these projects still go. Curl is probably more actively maintaining as things are being added to it and whatnot, but like it's a core piece of infrastructure in the world, and necessarily it has to be conservative in its change now, even if change is required.
Right. And the people who are there in the more functional forms of this, the people who are there, the custodians of these stabilized projects, have probably seen it all at this point, right? Like if you come along with some bright idea, like it's probably in the issue list. Like it's not new.
Yeah,
it reminds me of this sort of satirical thing that I saw once of like the, this is going to date me a whole bunch here, of like the forum, like the bulletin board for the Time Travelers Association. And the sticky post at the top of the forum is, do not go back in time and kill Hitler. Because if you do, then no World War II, which means no DARPA, which means no internet, which means no time machine, which means I have to go fix this again. So do not go kill Hitler. That's the sticky post, right? And it's sort of like the obvious thing is like, oh, can't you just do this? And in those mature projects, it's like, don't you think that we would have by now if we could?
The- the poor gray beard dripping over their beard as they are. It's like, well, let me tell you a story. We tried that in 1977 and it didn't work out then. And many people have tried since. You know, we've talked about this with comments actually in our comment episode.
Right.
There was the comment where it's like, you know, you put the explanatory comment that says, please don't change the following line. It looks like it should be changed to this, but whatever. However, if you want to try it and get it working and get all the unit tests passing, then go ahead. But if you don't, come back to this comment and bump the number. And the number's like 27. Right. 27 other people have failed before you.
Yep. So I think that's like the functional version. Because like I said, I think every piece of software will undergo this life cycle.
There's like the greenfield explosion of activity. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, you can do anything you like. You can completely change the API once a day, once an hour, even, because you've got no users. Mm-hmm. Even once you've got one or two users and they're happy enough, you can sort of say, really sorry, we're just completely revamping everything, you're gonna have to migrate, and we'll either help you or good luck, you know, move over to it. And then you reach the sort of middle age part, right? So that's sort of like your youth, and then your teenage years, when you've got, you can be a bit spiky still, mm-hmm. because, you know, your users are kind of like, well, okay, I guess so. And then you become a middle-aged person or an adult, and now you're like, well, I can't just go and change this thing because, you know, thousands of people will be affected by this. Mm-hmm. And so you have to slow down and be a bit more sensible and boring. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, but then, so what's the midlife crisis version of this? What is it? When the project changes anyway, it goes, ha ha, we're rewriting it all in Rust.
I mean, I think this is the, you know, do you have, are you like a, you know, cheeseburgers six times a week, no exercise, sedentary, you have a heart attack in your 50s please. Project.
Oh, right? I thought you were going to go somewhere else with this.
Yeah. Oh, no, yeah. Right. Or are you the, like, you know, super exercise, multivitamin, you know, the whole thing, and you live into your 90s, right? And the way to, like, achieve that sort of, like, longer life cycle is to preserve your ability to change for the things that are really important.
Right.
And not sort of fall into the trap of, oh, we're trying to cram everything in here, but we can't. So what this needs is a rewrite that can do all the things.
I see.
So there's lots of factors to this. One factor is being able to, like, manage change over time for a very long period and being able to say no to changes that don't make sense, as we sort of have been talking about here. Another thing I think is understanding that projects should only ever really get so big, right? Mm-hmm. If you try to cram everything into your system, you're going to either have to throw a ton of resources at it to be able to manage that kind of change. And it's still, the cost of that change is still going to be incredibly high. But a better way is, okay, maybe we don't have to rewrite this. What if we just made something else that could mm-hmm. fulfill the needs, right?
Which,
like, or split it in half, right? That's another way to do it.
Version 2-ish feeling to that, because that's one of the ways of avoiding the trouble and the problems of changing an existing project for which you have downstream customers, is to essentially make a new version and say, well, never the twain shall meet. You know, this is a new API. It's mm-hmm. a new version. You never need to touch it. It's essentially a new project. And that is a way of managing the change aspect of it. And what you're saying is you could split a project in two. I guess it's a different dimension there. What you're saying with one is you're saying, like, this serves the need of something. And you're saying that the only reason you would rewrite it, not the only reason. A reason to rewrite it is because, like, the internals are so hard you can't change it, you can't make those changes. And I'm thinking, well, there's also this, the periphery, there's the external interface, and mm-hmm. it's very hard, or maybe even impossible, to have a good experience when you have to support, like, a V1 API and a V2 API.
Yes.
It can be done, and obviously you can think about it beforehand, but
And like the V1 V2 API, I would be less suggestive of that. And this mm-hmm. is more about, like, as you're getting those requests for, like, can it also do this and can it also do that, really thinking about, like, should it do this and should it do that? Like, right. I'm not saying that your request isn't valid and that we shouldn't build that capability within our organization,
but
I'm just saying, like, maybe not in this code base.
Yeah.
Right. Cause if you look for those opportunities, then you're reducing the complexity of the system and also creating opportunities to deliver on those requests quickly, because you're potentially doing it in something else. If you're just throwing it into your code base because that's where your build system is and you've got the deployment already set up, and not because it actually belongs there, That's going to hasten your demise as a software project, right? That's right. Like eating the cheeseburgers, right? It's not good for you. So that is sort of like one way in which I think you can kind of deal with this, right? You can
stave off this tendency to make to a project becoming ossified is to say, yes. Well, okay, let's not put lots of things into it, which brings us possibly, arguably, unnecessary complexity, which right. then also tangles our feet up, makes it harder to change down the line, and then eventually we kind of abandon the project and move on to V2 of the thing or something different entirely.
Yeah.
That I could understand. Yeah.
Yeah, and that is separate from like splitting it. So like one approach for this is if you've identified parts of your system that have stopped needing to change, right? Mm-hmm. Like you're not getting any like your, you know, message bus dealy, whatever it is. I don't know, whatever part of the system. It's like, yeah, we've got this code. It's in the code base. We run the tests on every build. We haven't changed it in 3 years,
mm-hmm.
right? Maybe that's a library, and it's gonna be a library. You don't share it with anybody. You'll just pull it out, compile it one time, run the tests the one time. And if you ever need to change it, it's there, but you don't have to carry the complexity costs of that forever, right?
That's sort of
a cheap way to split things.
We've talked about things like the anti-pattern of commenting out code because it might be useful before mm-hmm. now. And this seems like a sort of similar feel to it where you're saying, look, it's not that I want to delete this code. It's valuable. I'm just going to extract it and put it somewhere else. And it's slightly more live than in source control and gone in my current incarnation because it's been published as a library separately. I like that. The usual argument against it, which is the one we did with the whole commented out code or code that you don't use that's in your project, but is that refactoring tools and things like that can bring it along for the ride. But if you can find a nice seam to extract right. that library, that's less of a problem anyway. It's like, yeah, well, this is where the compression library goes. We're not using compression anymore, but it's a really nice component. I'll take it out. We'll put it in the company drawer of like useful little components. And then we'll get on with our life. I don't have to keep it up to date or I don't have to do anything with it. It's there if I need it.
Well, and I'm saying like, even if it is being used, even if it is actively being used, but it's not being changed. Right. Like you go through and you look at your Git history and you see like, yeah, this code is executed every day in our system. Well, we haven't changed it since 2014. Right.
It's fascinating. Yeah. Yeah. I actually have a perfect example of that in my current code base where we lazily. So this is exhibiting all of the bad things, actually. That you said. So it was a serialization library. And in order to have like the tools that like command line tools that allow you to decode and re-encode and dump and debug serialized forms of data, there's a number of applications that go alongside the library that you would otherwise link with. And as I was writing that out, one of the first times in the company that we had a bunch of native code. And so I wrote a somewhat straightforward and small application, like CLI app framework with command line parsing and all that good stuff. And it's so convenient that in my subsequent projects, although I started off needing the serialization library part, I'd actually pull across the application framework as well through the library and mm-hmm. be like, oh, this is cool. We'll use it in my rest of my project. And now, of course, the serialization library has gone by the wayside, but I'm still depending on it because it's got this application framework. And, yeah. and I'm like, this is terrible. I'm pulling this huge amount of complexity of this serialization library to get like 15 lines of code that now if I needed to change, I have to cut a new version of the serialization library. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. that is a smell and I should go and fix that sooner rather than later in myself. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's easy to happen. I see what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, with all of these things, your ability to do this is going to be a function of your ability to decompose and refactor, which unfortunately is changing the system. So if you wait until the system is hard to change before you start thinking about these things, then you will never come back. Right. And you will wind up in that place where you are like, you know, the bad Phoenix where you're trying to rewrite the whole thing.
There's a username. Bad Phoenix.
Bad Phoenix. Yes.
Has entered the chat room. Oh no.
So I think, you know, again, I keep drawing parallels to, you know, health and, you know, the sort of middle age and everything.
It's on top of mind for some reason.
Yeah, right. Well, there you go. Maybe the tacos and beer that I had last night has this on my mind. If you want longevity in these projects, if you don't want them to ossify and then be completely routed around and then rewritten, then you have to have a long-term view on these things. You have to be like, I realize that we don't need to break this out now, but if we don't start doing things like this, it will be very difficult to do later. And then we just practically won't do it. And that means that we won't be able to change it. And then the organization will route around us, right? Mm-hmm. The problem is a lot of organizations, and this gets into some of the structural causes of this phenomena, a lot of organizations take a sort of project-oriented approach to building these kinds of systems.
Yep.
Right? They don't think of them as, the people and the software. Like when I think of software, it's like, I think those two things are inseparable, right? Like, handing someone a code base with no team to go with it is like a curse, mm-hmm. right? It's like, if you want to slow someone down, like, you know, take like an unspecified chunk of code and be like, here's this chunk of code from your most successful competitor. Boop. You'll kill their performance over the next 6 months as they try to poke through it and figure out what the hell's going on. Right. And so I view that those things as inseparable, right? Like if you have the people and you have the code and the code is loaded up into the people's heads and the people know how to change it. And as soon as you pull those things apart and the people move on to something else, the code will solidify.
Mm.
It will ossify, right? And nothing will accelerate that more than pulling people off of the team without giving them the ability to sort of organically replace the folks on the team. It's not that people should stay on projects forever. It's that you should bring people on, bring them up to speed, and then, you know, have other people move off, right? Have a good transfer of knowledge, not like the fake 2 weeks where you're like, oh, yeah, read the code and ask me if you have any questions, right? Like that's not really anything for anyone, right? It has to be like months. But if you have an organization that is project oriented, if you see software systems as you assemble a group of people, they do a project. When the project is over, they move on to the next project. Then you are encouraging this behavior of not looking out for the long term. And I'm saying, well, why would we extract the library? I'm going to be working on something else in 2 years. My goal right now, as told to me by my boss, is add these new pieces of capability. And I'm not going to stop to think if it's appropriate for this project. That would be not in my best benefit, right? Like that would not be in my self-interest. If my boss or some other stakeholder says, add this capability to my project, even if I know that it's not appropriate for the project, it's probably better for my bank account if I add it.
Right.
Because that's what success looks like at this company, right? Yeah. Is adding capabilities to software, right?
Yep.
So if that's the way that you think about it, then the problem is that this becomes a very sustaining and self-fulfilling prophecy where it's like project number three is rewriting project number two and project number two is rewriting project number one, right? And that just repeats over and over and over with a new crop of software engineers every few years and a new group of product owners and managers every few years, and they're just rewriting the same, solving the same problems over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And all of them getting promoted up and out as a result. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think in very large organizations, especially, this can go on and it's just a huge waste. And it's like, you know, you wonder why these giant tech companies get so stagnant. I think this can be one of the reasons why it happens is because they have the sort of project oriented view.
Yeah. That's a fascinating observation. So what have we got so far? I'm just looking at my list of how to not, make abandonware. We actually didn't really sort of define it as abandonware. I don't know, but like, you know, projects that have reached their sort of light terminal,
They've ossified and they've lost their support is how I would describe this
as abandonware. Support
as in there are no longer engaged, competent software engineers who are working on it, however slowly in the, you know, later phases, right? But working to change it. Like they have it all, they have all the complexity loaded up into their heads. They can be the ones to answer like, oh yeah, no, you can't do that to Zlib and here's why.
Yeah.
Right. That's the healthy outcome, the healthy long-term outcome. The abandonware is Anyone who would work on this project is a sucker. Right? No one understands how it works.
Yep.
No one wants to change it. There's no organizational benefit or value or recognition from changing it. It's just sort of seen like this old legacy thing. That's abandonware.
That's abandonware, right.
And so I think avoiding that is important.
Right. And so, yes, yeah, to the point, one way to avoid getting yourself into that situation is to be very careful about what you put into the project in the first place so that you mm-hmm. don't add complexity that's unnecessary, which might be beguiling in the short term. Because if your users need it, maybe you should supply it. But then, you know, you end up growing the Homer car, right? Yeah. If you're not careful. Right. And then you're like, oh, this is too complicated to even work. And then the project comes to a natural end. What else have we said?
Splitting.
So,
splitting software. And you can split it into multiple systems. You can pull libraries out. You can just change the way your build works. So you can just sort of shove a piece of code over in the corner and be like, yeah, we haven't changed this in 10 years and we're probably never gonna. There's lots of ways to split things, but splitting
and then not paying the cost of having it there, or right. Absolutely minimizing it. So scaling right. down to zero, the cost of carrying a bit of code, be it because it's put in a repo and then you don't look at it again, but it's there. Yeah.
You're shrinking your complexity burden.
Yeah,
by doing
back down
that,
again. Yeah.
Which makes it easier to change.
Yeah. Yeah. And then obviously using techniques that make it easier to change full right. stop and be, you know, so obviously the word that you haven't said so far. What word could that be? I'm just trying to remember. What word? Let's think. Is it? Arresting? No. Chesting?
It's not coming to something. Mind.
All right.
Know.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, yes. if you've written it so that it's tested and testable, yes.
right.
and you've got good tests that help you and aren't brittle and don't mm-hmm. make it so that you have to do things in a particular way, else, you know, it's hard to change all the things we've talked about once or twice mm-hmm. on this podcast, then it makes it easier to change. You know, good tests make it easier to make change and be confident that you've made the right changes and you haven't broken anything. So all mm-hmm. those good things that obviously helps a project's longevity. I mean, maybe implied in what you've said is organizational foresight and appropriate usage of Conway's law in the right way to right. say, you know, you mentioned project-based development and like moving on from a project to the next project only to have the last one cave in and then you kind of replace it as a sort of almost like a cycle, which
right.
certain, again, Conway's law I'm going to bring out here, you know, you can see that happening maybe with a consultant-based development where you bring in a bunch of consultants and they build a thing and build a thing and build a thing and they're like, okay, we've done the thing, and they walk away from it. And then a couple of years or maybe less later, the folks who are left with the thing are like, we don't know how to change it. We don't know really what it is.
Right.
And we hire some more consultants who say, well, it'll cost us this much to take your existing one, or we can write a new one for you. And you're like, well, let's do with the new one. That seems, and then I mean, I've never been a consultant, but you're nodding at me. So
I have worked on projects that were very much, that were almost literally that.
Right.
Sidebar, 2009, I did a project for Bank of America, which had recently acquired Countrywide Mortgage in the mortgage collapse. And they had to revamp their mortgage default system because it had gone from processing like one thing a day to hundreds of things a day keep up.
That's actually the human cost sat sort of the other side of that. It's kind of poignant, actually.
It was a crazy time.
Wow.
It was a crazy, crazy time for me and the world. That was very much that project, is that like the right thing to do in theory on paper would have been to take that existing system and scale it up or change it in some way.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't changeable for various reasons, right? And so what they had to do was rewrite it from scratch.
Right. And I mean, I don't think it's never a good idea to rewrite something from scratch, because sometimes there are some fundamental things that you wanted to change mm-hmm. or you want to try a different way. But yeah, it shouldn't be your default strategy for dealing with a changing environment around you.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, I think when I think about rewrites, it's like, first of all, be really clear that you really actually do need to do it, because it's almost certainly going to be so much harder than you think it's going to be. But also, please make sure this is the last one, right? The cycle ends with me, right?
Right.
because, and you need to sort of ask some questions, like they're, you know, important organizational questions about like, how did we get to this state in the first place? Like what forces were in play that got us to a point where this code had been abandoned and needs to be rewritten? Because as an individual person, you may not be able to avoid that future unless something has changed in the environment to make it feasible, right? And things do, and it's not to say that you can't, but that would be the first question that I ask with a rewrite, you know, maybe the second question, first question being like, do we really, really, really need to do this? And the second one is, how are we going to make this the last
version? Last time we do it? Yeah, that's a great thought. Yeah. So organizational structure.
Yep.
Ease of change in the first place.
Yep.
What am I missing? I've already forgotten. You see, I also went to the pub last night, a different pub to you, but I'm suffering a little bit here. I should have written these things down. Splitting the project.
Don't take on functionality capabilities that you can move out to other things, that are reasonable to move out to other things. Just because you can add them to your software doesn't mean you should.
Mm-hmm.
Think about whether you can sort of you can think of it as pre-splitting, right? Instead of putting it in here and then taking it out again, we're just going to put it somewhere else, right? Because it can go there and it will work fine over there, right? That's a way to keep your complexity down. For me, like I actually have pretty specific metrics in my brain for when I start getting worried that a piece of software is reaching its middle age and needs to be, you need to start thinking about how many cheeseburgers a week you're eating, right? when the lines of code are in the, you know, hundreds of thousands, when the test suite starts to take longer than my attention span, you know, we've talked about the rule of eights before, right? You know, 0.8 seconds. Yeah, that's great. 8 seconds. Okay. That's fine. 80 seconds. I've lost attention. Right. And so when you start making that transition from 8 seconds and it's 20 seconds and 30, you should be thinking, how are we going to split this? How are we going to move parts out of this? How are we going to decommission things? How are we going to get a little bit more life out of this software? Because if it keeps going like this, eventually it's going to take 20 minutes to run the unit tests and three of them will fail randomly when you do, and you just got to rerun them. And, you know, the build takes a day to actually work and deploy. And any request that comes in to change the software will take a minimum of a week.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you're looking like you've come to the end of your...
I'm trying to think if there's anything else to say about this. And I feel like that's probably about it. I mean, there's other tangents here that we could maybe go on, but I think the main takeaway is just, you know, if you're a person in a technology organization that has a leadership role, and you're looking at your organization and you see this pattern, this dysfunctional pattern of death and rebirth, and you're wondering how to fix it, I think the place to start with is, what is your relationship between the software and the people? Because if your model of this is people build things and then they build other things and then they build other things, and you don't have an engineering culture of sort of custodialism, I guess, where you have, you know, well-compensated senior engineers who are responsible for software that is a key part of your organization and isn't expected to change all that much because it's in its latter stages of life, then you're just going to get this constant rebirth, right? And maybe because of your organization, you're incentivized to do that. And that's what you're supposed to be doing there. And that's how you're going to get your exit and move on to your next job.
But that's not a place where I want to work.
That's not a place where I want to work either. Yeah.
No. Well, I think we've done a pretty good job of covering all the bases. And given this is, you know, as you say, your 12 pages of notes, which, dear listener, do not exist. Ben is completely making this up on the cuff.
Yeah.
That was very interesting. And I think I'm going to have to go back and do some refactoring in my serialization library, which I've been meaning to do. But yeah, now I feel ashamed.
No, you have an opportunity to extend your software's life.
Right.
And you should take advantage of it.
I should.
Not many people have that opportunity.
That's true.
Yeah.
All right, my friend. Well, I guess we'll leave it here then.
Yeah, sounds good.
You've been listening to Two's Compliment, programming podcast by Ben Rady and Matt Godbolt. Find the show transcript and notes at www.twoscompliment.org. Contact us on Mastodon. We are at twoscompliment@hackyderm.io. Our theme music is by Inverse Phase. Find out more at inversephase.com.